Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Welcome to the Happy Hour Garage, featuring a duo of racing gals who live for the thunder of horsepower, the smell of high-octane fuel, and burning rubber at 200 miles an hour. They believe a day at the Speedway is like a day at the spa. Together, they bring you NASCAR news and interviews and get you ready for the races each week. And now, here's your hosts, Shannon Yoakum and Maureen Kelly from the Happy Hour Garage.
Helen, start your engine.
Hello and happy Friday, snow-melted day. This is Shannon, your host of the Happy Hour Garage from beautiful British Columbia today. We had a rotten snowstorm this morning, and now it's all melted for some peculiar reason. It's a very strange winter here.
Maureen,
you're getting snow right now, aren't you?
I am, yeah. It's been snowing all day here in Philly. It's expected to stop shortly, though, so that would be great.
Oh, that's good. And Buddy's going to get a load of it tomorrow. I just thought I'd share it with you, Buddy.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Our next guest had a huge influence on my own life. Her spirit, her incredible sense of adventure, and her strong work ethic were all things that I admired and patterned myself after as I was growing up. Nothing was impossible if you learned it. Can't be done was not a phrase in her vocabulary, and I always really admired that. My parents taught me and my brother that if you were willing to learn, you could do it. If you desired something, make it an adventure and make sure you do it right. Gender was never an excuse. Janet Guthrie is the epitome of this. From her love of books and adventures, she has filled her life with the I can do it spirit. From flying to physics, from wrenching to racing, she has lived life to the fullest. So full, she even wrote a book about it called Janet Guthrie, A Life at Full Throttle. Please welcome Janet Guthrie to the show and also wish her a happy belated birthday and congratulations on your recent nomination for the Landmark Award from the NASCAR Hall of Fame. Welcome to the show, Janet.
Well, thank you very much, Shannon. I'm delighted to be a guest here.
We are, you have no idea how excited everybody is. You are my hero. I know you're Marine is also. And we are just stoked. It's not because you're a woman, but it's because we have a lot in common. And we admired your everything you have done in your life has been through hard work and tenacity. And you know what? You're doing all of these things from the physics stuff in the early days to building your own engines, to racing, and all the way through and everything in between was always, it's something you did yourself and you worked very hard at it. What drove you?
Oh, I what I generally say is that I was born adventurous and grew up insufficiently socialized. Flying was really my first love. I soloed when I was 16, had a private license at 17, a commercial and flight instructors by the time I got out of college. But I went to work in the aerospace industry at Republic Aviation out Long Island outside of New York City. And the airspace was too crowded to go and have fun in. I mean, there was no place where you could go and do aerobatics. So instead of buying an AT-6, which I had my heart set on, I bought a 7-year-old Jaguar XK120M coupe just because it was beautiful. And that was the big watershed there.
That car seems to have meant a lot to you. I mean, I read a story about you trying to get it to hold oil and getting all this help from all these people, and you couldn't figure out why it wouldn't hold oil, and then discovered that the oil pan or something was dented on the inside after many days, and your excitement was incredible on that.
Well, that was actually my first race car, which was an XK140 that I bought to go racing in the Sports Car Club of America. I got my license in 1963, And over that winter, 63-64, I rebuilt the engine because it needed it, assembled the short block in the back of my station wagon, did the valve job in my dining room, just following the shop manual very, very carefully. And so I had it all assembled, the first engine I'd ever built with my own hands, and it was in the car, and I started it up, and there was no oil pressure. And then there were days of mystery. What in the world could have happened? Well, I had bought this engine from a wreck, and apparently in the course of that wreck, the bottom of the oil pan had been very smoothly and uniformly crunched, pushed upward, so that the oil pump intake sat in a blind alley when the pan was fitted to the engine. Oh, I'll never forget the joy of that discovery, replacing the oil pan, firing up the engine, and there is oil pressure. And that engine, by the way, went 14 SCCA races in 1964, including the first ever 500-mile or 6-hour race, I forget which, it amounted to the same thing, national championship race at Watkins Glen, New York. In which we finished sixth overall, my co-driver and I. So that was my engine.
You've raced in so many different types of series. You went from, you've even hill climbed, right, in the early 60s. Were you not doing some of that too?
Yes, that was how I started. That was with my XK120 coupe, the car that I drove to work every day. I started in Gymkhana's, what are now called autocrosses or solo competitions, and then progressed to hill climbs, more of the same, only faster, and discovered I really liked it.
And why, like, I know your father, you were born in Iowa, but you guys basically grew up in Florida, and I read something that your father had managed an airport in Iowa, and then he became a pilot for Eastern Airlines, and consequently moving you down to Florida out in the boonies. Now, is this where you started to discover the life of books and wanting to do all this stuff? Like, what drove you to get in a car and climb a hill?
Oh, well, books were always very important in my life. Books were important in the family. There were books everywhere in the house. There were always books. And actually, I think I have a line in my own book saying after my first hill climb at Ellenville in the Catskills in about 1962, 61 or 62, that I had never read about anything like this, and that was part of the allure. It was a whole new world.
Even your own education, Janet, was a whole new world. I went to college in 1974, and I was one of not many women in my programs at that time. When you went there, how many women were actually in a physics and an engineering program to begin with physics engineering?
Well, I did start out in the College of Engineering at the University of Michigan, which I picked out of a book because at that time, women couldn't fly for the airlines, women couldn't fly for the military. So I thought I would try the next best thing and major in aeronautical engineering. But after my freshman year spent mixing up batches of sand, concrete, and gravel and drawing pictures of the threads on screws, I decided that wasn't really what I had in mind and changed to a physics major. But to answer your first question, if I remember correctly, in a freshman engineering class of 2000, there were 8 women. But I mean, I just never let anything like that bother me. I mean, it just never occurred to me that I was an exception of some sort.
Which has probably stood you in good stead the rest of your life as well, I'm sure. Right after that, it was when you graduated from those programs that you looked into the NASA program. Can you talk a little bit about how you approached that and what happened to you at that point?
Oh, well, I had been working for Republic Aviation in their research and development facility for 4 years when the scientist astronaut program was announced. And a coworker came into my office with a copy of one of the trade magazines and said, "Look at this. You fit all these requirements, your height, your pilot's license." He said, "The work you've been doing here in the last 4 years, if you'd done it at a college, you'd have your PhD," because that was the thing. It gave all the specifications that you had to meet. And PhD wasn't required, but it was preferred, and I didn't have one. And so at first I thought the idea of applying for this program was quite improbable, but I bounced the idea off some of my friends, and they said, "Go for it. What have you got to lose?" So I did apply, and I did make it through the first round of eliminations for the scientist astronaut program, but I got cut at the second round, presumably because I didn't have a doctorate.
Mm. And how did you get to the Indy 500? I mean, you hold a lot of records in a lot of different types of racing, including Indy, of course. How did you get involved with that?
Well, most college graduates at that time, if they had an interest in motorsport, would go into Sports Car Club of America racing. It was the fashionable form of the sport in the 1950s and 60s, and to some extent on into the early 70s. So that's what I did, Sports Car Club of America. And after a couple of years, I started getting rides at the Daytona 24-hour and the Sebring 12-hour, where I won my class a couple of times. And but after 13 years of fielding my own cars and building my own engines and doing my own body work, I was out of money. I had no house, no jewelry, no husband, no insurance. I had one used up race car, and I thought, well, you know, you really must come to your senses. And that was the point at which an IndyCar team owner whom I'd never heard of left a message on my answering machine saying, "How would you like to take a shot at the Indianapolis 500? Well, I thought to myself, yeah, right, another joker. But the next morning, he had said he was from Oregon, and I was in New York. And so the next morning, I called up Chris Economike Mackey, the late great guru of National Speed Sport News, and I asked him, "Who is Rolla Volstead?" And Chris filled me in, and Rolla Volstead was real. He wasn't a joker. And so I returned the call, and it went on from there.
And when you first went to Indy, I read somewhere that, I'm not quite sure about the timing on this, that there was no women allowed in the pits or the press box or anything like that. Was that before you got there, or was that when you first got there?
That was before I got there. Actually, I think it was 1971, so it was 5 years later that I got there. In 71, a woman journalist filed a lawsuit that she should be admitted to the pits and garage area on the same basis as men were in order to do her reporting job. And a judge agreed with her. So at the time I got there in 76, there were still signs hanging on the chain link fence around the garage area every 50 feet saying, "By federal court order number so-and-so, persons are to be admitted to this area without regard to gender."
Oh, good grief.
Oh, my. That's hard to believe. You have any trouble with that yourself? Like, I know there's lots of stories about your early years at Indy there with Bobby Unser and Al Unser and a few other ones. And, of course, A.J. Foyt, the master of I love that guy. He's so upfront and clear, and there's nothing hidden with AJ. He comes to your rescue, you know, to sort of back you up against all this. Once you proved it on the track that you were equivalent to these guys and could run with them, of course the respect came. But that in-between time must have been interesting.
Oh, it was very difficult. Between the time that Ralph Alstead and his sponsor, Bryant Heating and Cooling, announced the program, and the time I drove my first IndyCar race at Trenton, New Jersey, in the beginning of May of 1976, the fur was just flying all over the country. I was quite astounded, because I'd been working and playing in men's fields for quite a long time and had no clue how much hostility toward a woman there taking a shot at Indianapolis there was out there. It was really an eye opener for me. But that was before they gained the experience of driving with me, and that first race at Trenton changed some minds quite quickly. I think it was Billy Vukovich, the son of the late great Bill Vukovich, who had been bad-mouthing me in the press before that first race. And afterwards, he told the newspapers, he said, well, I came up on her in the dog leg. Trenton was the only track in the country at that time for IndyCars that had a right-hand bend in it. And Billy said, well, I came up on her in the dog leg, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to have to get out of the throttle and it'll ruin my lap. He said, but instead she gained on me. So bit by bit, attitudes changed, and I must say it was a great pleasure to see them change.
Well, you know, you had two sayings that I thought were appropriate that are kind of famous. One is, you drive the car, you don't carry it.
Yes.
That one cracks me up every time I hear it. And racing is a matter of spirit, not strength, both of which are totally you. Did you ever go away from some of this bad crap that was being thrown at you and just cry?
No, that really wasn't my nature. I mean, mostly I could laugh at it because I knew they would learn better. They just hadn't had the experience of driving against a woman. Every now and then it made me mad and I'd go in the garage and kick some tires, but mostly I thought it was funny, actually.
I've never seen anything written about you ever showing a female emotion, let's call it that, for lack of a better word, for any of that junk that was thrown at you. I can only imagine how much worse that was when you came into the redneck world of NASCAR.
Well, in fact, NASCAR was a little worse, but that's another story.
Yeah.
No, the important thing to me was that I was able to get my hands on a car at those levels of competition. And, of course, once I was out on the track, all the rest of it simply vanished. That's the power of concentration you develop after 13 years of racing. You know that you have to have concentration, judgment, and emotional detachment, not getting angry or excited on the racetrack. You're purely focused on doing what needs to be done to put that car through that turn as fast as that car is capable of, and hopefully passing somebody else in the process.
Yeah, I read that you drove at Indy, I think it was in 78, with a broken wrist. How did you break your wrist?
Oh, a really stupid story. There was a charity tennis match, and the woman who was putting it on, I said, I don't play tennis. I don't know how to play tennis. And she said, well, come anyway and sign autographs. And so I had this box of photos, and I met another driver, a guy who actually confided in me his deepest, darkest secret. He had a master's in psychology. He said, if that gets out, I'll be ruined. Anyway, he said, well, let's play together. I don't know how to play tennis either, and we'll go early, and we'll get our rousing defeat out of the way early on, and then we can just sign autographs. So,
sounds good.
there we are, being rousingly defeated, and I tripped over one of my own feet and fell, and it turned out to be a cracked wrist.
Oh, no. But
that was melodrama, to be sure.
I wonder today if they would have let you drive under... I'm sure, oh, I guess they would, right?
Had they found out about it, there's not a doubt in my mind they wouldn't, but... I was able to keep it a secret, and almost nobody knew about it. Certainly the establishment didn't know about it, and so it gave me a little trouble in the race, but I quickly learned how to reach over and shift with my left hand, and so that was how I drove the race.
Mm-hmm. And I remember... Go ahead.
That wasn't my worst problem. There were other problems as well. The single worst problem, that was the 1978 race. The single worst problem was probably a blocked vent in the refueling tank in the pits, which made refueling a horribly slow process. I had a car that year that I thought... the best it could probably finish was fifth if we didn't have trouble. Well, we did have trouble. There were some other things also. And so I got a ninth place out of it. But still, a top 10 back in those years, that was something to be proud of.
Mm. I was so excited that year. I was watching that race with my family, and I remember thinking, oh, my God, she can do this. She can do this. And, you know... I want to say, I don't remember how I felt when you finished ninth. Now, knowing what I know about the industry itself and what it takes to put a car together and, you know, what it takes in the pits and everything, I so admire the fact that you were able to finish ninth, because I did read later on that A.J. Foyt remarked saying, no one knows how hard it is for Janet because... she doesn't get the same equipment that most of the guys get.
That may have been true. The only year I had a car that I thought was capable of running up front at Indianapolis was 1979. And that year we qualified, and then I had only just met the guy who was my chief mechanic, but he was brilliant. And so in practice after qualifying, we got the car going faster than what we had qualified at, which is rather unusual. And unhappily, on the second lap of that 1979 Indianapolis 500, I had four burned pistons for reasons that remain a mystery. So that was the closest I ever got to a car that was capable of running up front.
That's crazy. Did you ever hurt yourself during your Indy years at all?
Oh, well, you don't drive for, let's see, how long did I drive altogether? 63 through 85, some 22 years. You don't drive race cars that long without... being involved in a few incidents that give you racing rheumatism, but I never was hospitalized or anything like that.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah, I couldn't find anything significant requiring hospitalization for you. And tell us about your NASCAR days. I heard an interview where you talked about, I think it was in the World 600, I understand it, Humpy Wheeler secured you a car. You ended up finishing 15th or something, and that was 1976. But the story I was reading that had me chuckling was when you came down pit road and you weren't quite used to the difference in brakes, and you spun on pit road in a donut and pulled into your pits. And tell us the rest of that story about that NASCAR official.
Oh,
that's funny.
Well, that was pretty funny. By then, I had already driven A.J. Foyt's backup car in practice at Indianapolis, and he decided not to let me make a qualifying attempt with it, although I would have obviously put it in the field had he done so. So Humpy Wheeler had all this in motion down in Charlotte because he had been annoyed that newspaper headlines were paying attention to me up in Indianapolis rather than his very own 600-mile NASCAR Cup race the same day. So I didn't want to hear about it until my Indianapolis was over with, which was the day after the last day of qualifying. Rollo Volstead and I sat down with representatives from Charlotte, including Linda Ferrari, who was my car owner and became my team owner. And I said, yes, of course. I remember saying to Rollo, when he asked if I wanted to go down to Charlotte, would I rather stay around here and bask in the whatever? Surely you know the answer to that by now. So off I went to Charlotte. I had never even seen a stock car race. The car was late arriving, and when it arrived, it was not handling properly at all. And Rollo Volstead, to whom I owe so much, I can't even begin to tell you how much, Cale Yarbrough had driven for Rollo Volstead at Indianapolis, and Rollo called up Cale and said, I want you to take her car out, and unless you approve of it, she isn't to drive it. And Cale said to Rollo, well, I don't believe in what you're doing, but I'll do it for you. And so Cale did take my car out in practice, and he didn't go any faster than I had been, which wasn't fast enough to make the field at all. And he looked pretty thoughtful, and along comes Junior Johnson. I mean, the great Junior Johnson. And Junior and Cale looked at each other and had a little conversation in that kind of shorthand that people do who've worked together a long time. And Junior turned to his chief mechanic, Herb Knabb, and said to him, give them the setup. I will never, never forget those words. And what a huge difference it made. Suddenly I had a drivable car in my hands. And so after 7 more laps of practice with the brand new setup, I did make the field, right behind Dale Earnhardt Sr. and Bill Elliott. And as you said, I finished 15th.
And what happened when you came down? I know you, with Junior Johnson is one of my heroes, I've got to say, and his bootlegging adventures way back in the day before NASCAR really became NASCAR are famous. And it was always said that they had to, you know, the cops would be chasing them and they'd get around a corner out of sight, pull emergency brake on, crank around and go the other way to escape. You came down pit road and spun around and then pulled into your pits, and the NASCAR official came towards you. What did he say, and what did you say to him?
Oh, yes, that story. I lost track of it there. Yeah, what happened, there was a yellow light, and I prided myself on never missing a yellow light. Charlotte, of course, is a high bank track, and I figured I could get myself wowed down and into pit lane without having to go around one more lap. Well, I came down off the high banking onto the flat part a little bit too fast and eased out toward the outside of pit road to give myself a little more room to slow down, and got 2 wheels in the marbles, the bits of chewed up racetrack and whatnot that accumulate out there, and sure enough, around I went and didn't hit anything, got turned around. This is in practice now, mind. Mm-hmm. Motored very sedately back down to my pit, and here comes Don Wall, who ran pit road. And Don was 6 feet tall and about 4 feet wide, and he was an ex-Marine sergeant, and he was stomping in my direction. And he got down to the window of the car and glared in at me, and I looked up at him and I said, well, I heard you couldn't drive down here with the good old boys unless you could do a 180-degree turn on a 2-lane road, so I thought I'd better show you I could do that.
I love it.
That's such a good story. What did he say?
Don never said a word. He looked at me, and I looked at him, and I silently conveyed that I knew I'd done wrong, wouldn't do it no more. And he turned around and walked back up pit road, and that was that.
I love that.
That is Janet, a great story.
If you had your preference of the vehicles, which did you prefer to drive, the Indy car, the Indy models, or the stock cars?
A slightly complicated question, because back then it was the Indianapolis 500 that it wasn't the most important race. It was the only race. And any racing driver would have given their eye teeth for a chance to qualify for the Indianapolis 500. And I loved driving those cars. They were very precise and needed very delicate handling. But the NASCAR Cup cars of that time, you felt as if you were herding a bunch of loosely collected parts down the road, like herding sheep or something. And yet somehow under load, when you ran into the turns at speed, all those loosely collected parts, if they were properly set up, would settle into a configuration that somehow worked. For pure, flat-out fun, I really enjoyed NASCAR Cup racing.
Yeah.
Interesting answer.
It is. You know what? I can see why you answer it that way, though. It makes sense, because you come at it from an engineering perspective as well. You know how all that junk puts itself together. And all. I imagine that was helpful at that time. To know that. Maybe did you garner more respect at all from the guys in NASCAR because you were an engineer?
I don't think that made any difference. It took a little longer in NASCAR for things to change. It took until about August of 1977 before I could walk through the garage area without guys looking squinty-eyed at me. But, you know, presently, they too figured out that I was what I said I was, a race car driver who did the same things on the track that they did on the track, and was a clean driver and could give them some good competition. So the initial ruckus eventually died down.
I love the way you talk. The initial ruckus, it's perfect. It describes it perfectly. Was there somebody in the NASCAR side that kind of not took you under their wing, but kind of said, hey, she's okay first, and sort of became a friend?
Well, I can't say I was ever really, really close with any of the drivers, but at that very first race, Charlotte, Donnie Allison gave me some very valuable tips. And I'll always be grateful to him for that.
Interesting. You finished sixth at Bristol in a super speedway car, which is crazy. I will soon be going to Bristol in April to meet Buddy for the very first time, which is quite exciting. And I'm looking, when I go to that track again, I'm going to picture your car, super speedway car, finishing sixth at that race. That was pretty special.
I was pretty happy about that. We were all pretty happy about that. We got to the track, took it out in practice, and I came in, and my chief mechanic, Jim Lindholm, said, "How's it feel?" I said, "Well, it feels pretty good to me." So we qualified it and went back to the motel and sat around and drank beer and come race day, in practice before the race, we were looking for a race setup. So he changed a few things, and I went out and came in, and he said, "Well, how's it feel?" I said, "Well, it feels pretty good to me." And so, indeed, we ended up with a sixth-place finish. We had run near the top on so many times. We'd run in the top 10, and then some darn thing would happen. It was really nice to achieve that there at Bristol. And that car carried 500 pounds more on the nose than the short track cars that most of the top drivers brought there.
Wow. And that was, you had that car simply because of budget and funding, correct? You couldn't afford to build a short track car.
No, it was our only car.
Yeah, and we learned that from Ned Jarrett, too, when we were talking to him some time ago, that you couldn't always afford to have a backup car or a car for this kind of track or that kind of track, or, you know, you just had one car.
Well, at that time, the middle 70s, most of the top drivers had cars for super speedways and cars for short track, and they were, in fact, quite different, but we just had the one and made the best of it.
And you often say you didn't retire, you just ran out of money. when you in the 1980, after the Daytona 500, where you finished, by the way, 11th, and that's still a heck of a good record. And did you never got into another race car again after that?
No, in the middle 1980s, I drove for the Peugeot factory team on road racing circuits like Mid-Ohio and the Nelson Ledges 24-hour, and that was fun. We actually won our class at the Nelson Ledges 24-hour, the name of which was the longest day. It wasn't like driving at the top. It didn't summon the same 110% that you have to give. So that was pretty much the end of it.
That's sad. I mean, it's sad. I know it's hard to get. It's still hard to get funding, particularly in NASCAR, which is our sphere of, you know, what we mostly focus on. Do you wish you had more time racing in either, at the top level of either sport?
It was absolutely heartbreaking to me that I had to drop out. I can't tell you how very, very bad that was, because although in IndyCar I only drove 11 races, in NASCAR over the course of 5 years I drove 33 races, 19 of them in 1977. And I'd run with the leaders, I'd led a race. I felt sure I was going to win one in shorter than the five-year average of that time. And I'm afraid I still regret that I was not able to continue, particularly in NASCAR Cup racing, but also in IndyCar racing, where I think, although I can't offer the certainty, that I would have done well there also. Actually, my best finish in IndyCars was a fifth. So
yeah. Right. Which is, that's pretty good to me.
Yes. What would you say your greatest achievement was so far in your life, not necessarily to do with racing, but just in general?
Oh, boy. Well, certainly any driver of that era, when, as I probably said, 80 or 90 cars could be entered for the Indianapolis 500 and only the fastest 33 in qualifying would start the race. I mean, you used to see big, tough guys who'd never heard of sensitivity training at the end of qualifying on the last weekend walking back from pit lane openly crying, big tears running down their faces because they hadn't made the field at Indianapolis. I really wish I'd been able to continue, but in NASCAR Cup racing particularly, I really wish I'd been able to continue, and I'll wish that until my dying day. What can I tell you?
Once a racer, you're always a racer. That never really goes away, does it?
Well, I think at this point of my life, I'm no longer young, for sure.
young as a number.
I've changed a bit, but that burning desire was with me for a long, long time.
What do you do for fun these days? I understand you like gardener. I actually have a degree in horticulture, so I'm with you on that, in the gardening.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, I love gardening. That's my relax Shannon time, I call it.
Yeah, this was the first house I had ever owned when I was racing. I had an apartment in Midtown Manhattan. And when I got here, I carefully planned a double row of yellow daylilies along the side of the driveway, the earlier blooming and shorter ones alternating in front, and then the later blooming and taller ones in the back row, and that was a pretty successful installation. But I had a little hiking group here, mostly women, just between 3 and 8 of us who would go out 2 times a week and up into the mountains. Maybe only a mile and a half, 2 mile trail, but 1,500, 2,000 feet altitude gain. And I really enjoyed that.
Mm. And you would have had to learn, I mean, that's a whole different gardening zone in Colorado. It's very actually similar to here. We're, I think, a bit hotter, more desert-like, but a similar zone. You would have, did you count on those ladies to help you learn some of that stuff?
No, I learned it out of books.
I was gonna say, or did you get it out of a book?
Got it out of books, just like I learned how to build an engine out of the Jaguar's shop manual.
All three of us love to read, so we're yep. with you on that one. And you married in 1989, and you married a pilot, actually, Warren Levine. Or
yes.
Is that Levine? Levine.
Yeah, he pronounced it Levine. Different people pronounce that name different ways. He was a captain with American Airlines, and he loved flying like I loved racing, so we understood each other. Unhappily, he passed away at the end of 06.
Mm-hmm. I read that he died of a heart attack. That's a real shame, and our condolences.
Yeah, thank you. He was a really good guy.
Yeah. It's nice that you had someone in your life that shared the passions, or at least understood them.
Yes, just so.
What do you think about today's women in NASCAR? And I'll give you a couple names, and maybe you know them, maybe you don't. Sarah Fisher, Dalena Harvick, Kelly Earnhardt, Shirley Muldowney.
Well, Muldowney was a drag racer.
Yes.
So that's a whole different kettle of fish.
It is.
Sarah Fisher was mostly in IndyCars, although she did do some stock car racing. And she was the one that I thought would be the first to win an IndyCar race. She came out of sprint cars. She had a pole position in the Kentucky IndyCar race. She had a podium finish also in Kentucky in the IndyCar race. She was really, really good. But just like me, she had trouble finding money. And eventually had to back down, retire, started running her own team. She has 2 adorable kids and runs a facility in Speedway, Indiana now that is a go-kart track and restaurant with her husband. Her kids are so cute. And but I wish she had gotten a proper chance. Among the other IndyCar drivers, Simona DiSilvestro, Catherine Legg, the talent is out there. It's just a question of who gets a good ride.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're still not quality rides.
Except for Danica.
You can tell. Well, that's true. Yeah, let's not take that down. Now, would you have loved to have had Danica's ride, perhaps, today?
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Would I have loved that? Would I have mm-hmm. loved Danica's money? I read yesterday that she's worth $50 million. Good God.
Wow. that's numbers even hard to imagine. But I imagine you would have done very nicely with that car and everything that goes with it.
Well, of course, racing is entirely different now. I mean, I wouldn't have known what to do with a spotter. I had a mirror, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
That's a good one. That's true, right?
I never thought of that.
If you ever listen in, like Shannon and I both listen in to the spotters during races, and it's a whole nother language that they speak. And, it's like 4 on your L, 3 on your right, it's crazy. I just want to say, just let them drive.
I think the spotter's voice would drive me crazy listening to it constantly like that. I would just want to say, shut up! it's just nuts. If you were 20 years old now, what would you be doing?
Well, if I were 20 now and the same person I was back then, I'd be about halfway through college, and it's hard to say because things are so very different. were involved in wars that I don't believe in. So I was about to open my mouth and say I would love to be a fighter pilot flying off an aircraft carrier, but considering the kind of wars we're in now, I can no longer say that. I don't know the answer to that one.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Somebody asked me that once, and it's sort of a roundabout question to say, do you have any regrets if you could go back and change something back then? You know, sometimes you say, you know, I was born in the wrong generation. You know, I would have loved to, personally, have loved to have been more involved in the business side of NASCAR, kind of like Kelly Earnhardt and Dalena Harvick. But of course, now I'm too old for that. But you know what I mean? That's what I'm talking about, that kind of thing. You know, if you had a chance to go back and do something that you didn't do, what would it have been?
Well, I pretty much spent my life doing what I wanted to.
Exactly.
As best I could under the circumstances.
Yeah.
Yes, I bet you don't have any.
Maybe not. Janet, do you still fly? As a pilot.
No, let's see. The last time I got my logbook signed off was because your license lasts forever. You just
right.
have to get your logbook signed off every couple of years or so. Was 1980, and I really haven't flown since then.
Oh, my 91-year-old father-in-law. He plans to fly this weekend, and my daughter will be up there with him, apparently, for the love of flying, you know. He flies up to New Hampshire and back, but I'm sure that's not where he's going this weekend. He was under the weather. What else do you do in Colorado at this point now? Colorado's such a beautiful,
gorgeous.
A beautiful state, yeah.
Well, I have given up skiing. I mean, too many of my friends have spent a year in neck braces or doing ACL therapy because they were hit by a snowboarder.
Yes.
So you get to a certain point, you don't bounce quite so well anymore. And so I quit that, and I'm afraid Colorado is getting a bit cold, dark, and slippery at this point. I'm not sure what I'm going to do next. The first problem is to empty out my house of a lifetime's worth of memorabilia. That is a project.
Mm.
You need a special person for that. You need help. Don't throw it away, please.
Yeah, phone us. We'll come and help you.
Yep. Yeah, no problem. We'll be right out.
Mm-hmm. You do have some of your stuff in the Smithsonian too. I mean, I think you you don't. I'm not sure. I don't even know how to say this, but I don't think you fully realize the impact you had on not only racing but on other females to inspire them. And I think you're very modest about that part of it, or maybe you're uncomfortable. I'm not sure which it is, but you know, that kind of stuff that you have is priceless. And before we're done this show, I would just like to talk to you off the air and order one of your books, and if you would autograph it for me, I'd be delighted.
Well, surely I'd be glad to. I do still have some boxes of books in the garage, although it is out of print now. I keep thinking I'd like to get it reissued as an e-book,
mm-hmm.
That's in the middle of a long list of things I need to do.
Well, you got to keep busy, right? That's what keeps you young. You and my father are the same age, and he, like you, is an adventurer and young for his age and full of ideas and energy, and I really admire that in people. I have one more question for you, and this kind of is out of nowhere, but you mention a fellow by the name of Tom in your book where you're talking about that car with the oil pan problem. Who was Tom?
Oh, Tom was a guy whom I dated on Long Island at that time. He was crewing for another Grumman engineer when we met at Vineland, New Jersey, a racetrack mm-hmm. that is long since defunct. But we would go to movies and out to dinner and this and that, and he crewed for me a few times. A really nice guy, but he was the one who finally backed off a bit, and he would call me up every now and then and tell me about his new sailboat and his ski house in Vermont. And then he would say, "Are you still racing?" And I would say, "Yes." And that would be the end of the conversation.
Really? Was he threatened by your being famous? No,
he wasn't threatened at all. It was just that he saw what an obsession it was for me.
Oh, I gotcha.
And figured he didn't want to try to compete with that.
Did you ever have, in over the years with NASCAR, this has changed a little bit, but they used to have, with the guys, women would flock to them like mad. Did you have that happen in reverse? Did people want to date you because of you being a famous race car driver?
No, that doesn't seem to be that all appealing. I mean, it takes a pretty secure guy to date a woman racing driver or a woman who has done all the other stuff that I did. But that's nice. I like guys who are secure.
I think Buddy wanted to ask you about the landmark award. Go ahead, Buddy.
Yeah, what would that mean to you to win an award like that?
Well, it certainly would be a great honor. I was nominated for it last year and wasn't named, and I just learned, I guess it was day before yesterday, that I'd been nominated again. I was really astonished when I was named to the International Motorsports Hall of Fame that's based in Talladega. That was just totally amazing to me. I think that happened in 2005, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Then, of course, years and years ago, I was named to the Women's Sports Hall of Fame. That presentation ceremony took place in the ballroom of the Plaza Hotel in Manhattan. I was really thrilled, and Johnny Rutherford came to present the award. That was a lovely evening.
Yeah, he's a name I remember from back in the day.
He's a
what? I just wanted to ask you, do you still follow the sport? And if so, who is your favorite driver, and what do you think about the way the sport has evolved, NASCAR, I mean?
Well, of course, it's so much more computerized than it used to be. I mean, at Indianapolis, how I tried to figure out what the suspension was doing was I went to a florist shop and got florist's clay and stuck it in between the spring coils. Now the computer readouts are right there in the pits. The person looking at the computer knows more about what the driver is doing than the driver does.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a completely different sport now. I'm glad I was in it when I was.
Yeah, it was, I think, a more creative time for sure. You especially, because you built these engines out of the back of your station wagon. I mean, you know how things worked, and sticking the clay in the spring, of course, would tighten you up a little bit. And, you know, all those kinds of things were things you invented on the fly.
Yes. And so did my team owner, Ralph Olstead. He never had a lot of money, but he got where he did through a great passion for the sport. So we were well matched, and I'll always be grateful to him.
Is he still with us?
Yes, he's in a nursing home now and has short-term memory issues, but he's still here. I think he'll be 98 this year.
Wow. Jeez, that's good old healthy living.
Yes.
Well, you know, I know that I could speak for both all three of us here, is that we have enjoyed this tremendously. We're happy that you chose to come on the Happy Hour Garage and share your stories with us. They're very special to us. You have no idea. It just gives me goosebumps talking to you.
Well, thank you. That's very flattering. And I should have mentioned, you can find some statistics on my website, which is just janetguthrie.com. And although, unfortunately, it hasn't been updated since 2010 because the program used to create it doesn't work any longer, but you can still find out how to get a copy of my book through my website.
Right. Yep. I did see all that, and I have it bookmarked. I can't tell you how much fun we've had, and we'll put up the show. Of course, you're not much of a computer person, are you?
I was able to find your interview of Morgan Shepherd, which was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, well, you can.
There's a lot of good ones in there. Oh. Check out some of the other ones. We've been blessed.
Yes.
We really have. We've been blessed to talk to some of the guys who have been in the industry for many, many years.
The one thing I didn't find on your website was how to find the other interviews, because I clicked on the link out of one of your posts, and that's how I got to Morgan Shepherd. But once I was there, I couldn't find all the other fascinating people you've talked to.
I'll fix that. We'll get you. There is a link on there to SoundCloud, but it might have. I noticed that the site is kind of funny right now, so I'll get Buddy to email you the link to SoundCloud where our storage is, and they're all there, all 100 and I think you're number 112.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of drivers.
That's a lot of talking. For me, that's something. Yes, we'll make sure that gets to you, and thank you again so much. And Buddy, you want to say goodbye?
Yes, Ms. Guthrie, it was an honor to have you on the show. I sure do appreciate it.
Well, it was a real pleasure talking with all of you. I enjoyed it so much.
Okay, that's great.
We hope you've enjoyed hanging out in the Happy Hour Garage. Thanks for tuning in. Please join Shannon and Maureen next week for another episode of NASCAR News, interviews, and stories. Check out our website at www.happyhourgarage.com for our previous shows and see what's coming up next.